Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. We're reconvening the Mid-Morning Book Club today. Jane Austen surely would have sympathized with what happened to my guest when he produced what can only be called a labor of love. David Shepherd spent two long years filling in details about the language and the customs and the dialogue in Pride and Prejudice. Open his annotated version to the Netherfield ballroom scene. You'll discover that the dances of the time involved standing in line and waiting while couples performed their movements, so there was plenty of time for conversation. Dip into one of my favorite scenes, the one in which the stolid Mr. Collins is trying to propose marriage to Elizabeth, and you'll learn that using the phrase "the violence of my affection" was a standard phrase back then in declarations of love. But when Mr. Shepherd, a historian and college professor, had completed his extraordinarily detailed work, he found out that publishers weren't lining up to buy it. In fact, no one would publish it at first. And that's exactly what happened to the first version of Pride and Prejudice, which was titled First Impressions. Jane Austen would go on to rewrite and resubmit the book, and it was published in 1813. David Shepherd didn't want to wait, so he self-published. The rest is a bit of Jane Austen literary history. David Shepherd joins us this morning from Albany, New York, to talk about Pride and Prejudice. David, good to have you on the program.
Oh, good to be here.
I am amazed at the amount of detail in this annotated version. Do you think that's what scared some of those publishers away at first?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to speculate on their motives. It's possible just because, I hadn't written anything before and I didn't have any particular credential that they might have thought made me the person to do it. That might have been what kept people from deciding for it. It's hard to say.
Well, why do you think you did have the credentials to do something like this?
Well, I thought that I didn't have the credentials in the sense of having, let's say, a prominent position at a university or a previous book on Jane Austen, but I thought I had insight into the book and knowledge of the period and a willingness to do it. And nobody before this had ever done a really fully annotated version of Pride and Prejudice like this.
Why do you think that is, that nobody had annotated it at the level of detail that you did?
I don't know. That's a good question. One thing is that, you really have to go through it carefully to find things that seem to call out for annotation. Other books may have a lot of references to all sorts of strange or obscure phenomenon that seem more obvious candidates for annotation. This involved a lot of very careful analysis of the book. And so it's hard to say, but nobody had done it before. And so I saw an opportunity there. And I really enjoyed doing it because I was always someone who loved Jane Austen so much.
Let's tell our listeners, you self-published the first annotated version of this.
And
then it became what you've called a Cinderella story. What happened?
Well, basically, it had been out there for a couple of years. I published a hardcover version myself, and it sold reasonably well, mostly on Amazon. And then at some point, someone who happened to work for Random House, I think in their international division, something like that, bought it out of personal interest. She happened to be a real fan of Jane Austen. She saw it on Amazon. She bought it. She liked it. And then I get the sense that she just started wondering, all right, who published this? Why haven't I heard of this before? Mm-hmm. And then she figured it might be self-published because there wasn't any other books by that under the label I used. She contacted me, asked if it was self-published, and if I was interested in having a regular publisher come out with a paperback version. And I said yes. And so she passed it on to somebody else in the company who decides on acquiring books. And a few weeks later, that person called me back and said, yes, we would like to publish it. And since then, everything's gone very well.
That's great. And there's been a good response to it from what I read. So there was a desire out there among Jane Austen fans to know this much detail, right?
Oh, yes, there was. And that was one of the inspirations. In fact, the number of books that are out about Jane Austen, also the number of websites devoted to her with extensive discussions of the book, of this book particularly, as well as other books by Jane Austen, the fact there's a Jane Austen Society, all of that was an inspiration to me in the sense that, yes, there is a market out here, and there are people who really are that devoted to Jane Austen, and also there are people I can reach because they're already organized into websites or societies and things like that.
But why? There's another movie, or a new movie, I think, coming out, or it's already been released, called Becoming Jane. Why the fascination with her?
Well, it's tough to say. Actually, I just saw Becoming Jane the other day. And there's a few weeks from now another movie coming out called The Jane Austen Book Club, an adaptation of a book. Well, I would just say my own answer would be that she's such an excellent novelist. And that, sometimes, of course, things acquire their own momentum. The more people talk about Jane Austen, the more interest there is.
Right.
And that, in turn, spurs more people to write books about her or takeoffs of her, and then more films to come out. But I think the fundamental foundation is that she's such a superb novelist. You have excellent stories, really well constructed. They're concerning basic human passions and issues of romance and marriage. She has such a brilliant insight into character psychology. She's also a very funny writer, so it's always enjoyable. And she has wonderful turns of phrases and is very clever in the way she uses words. You've got a whole gamut of very good qualities in her that I think make her one of the best, if not, to my mind, maybe the best novelist who's written in English language.
You say in the introduction that Jane Austen was doing something that a lot of writers were not doing in her era, which was she was writing novels that were very true to real life, right down to the smallest detail. Give me an example of that from Pride and Prejudice.
Of her realism?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. For example, she at various points mentions what carriages people have, and she always mentions the different type of carriages that people own according to what their social status is. Also, when she talks about financial arrangements, she is very precise in terms of how much money people have that would require to support a particular way of life. When she talks about traveling distance, she has at one point Elizabeth and her aunts go on a voyage. She again is very precise in terms of exactly how long they have to get from place to place. And we know she was very concerned about this. A niece of hers, late in her life, a niece was inspired by her example to start attempting her own novel. She sent it to her Aunt Jane. Jane Austen, they responded in some letters commenting on and criticizing the novels, and she comments a lot on the details, and in one case says, you have the characters traveling in one day between these two particular cities, it would take at least 2 days, so you must change that. so she really wanted to make sure you get all the details right, and I found that myself in investigating it, you know, reading a lot of historic works about the history of the period, about all different aspects, I found time and time again how absolutely accurate she was. And many of these historians who were writing about things would often refer to her and also comment about how she got it exactly right. No matter what particular phenomenon or aspect of the life of the time she was describing, she was always completely accurate.
I wonder why she felt compelled to do that, because, you know, in some ways, that's the subtext to what she's trying to do, which is create a fictional world. And yet she's very, very conscious that within the fictional world, there have to be things that are absolutely right. I wonder why.
Well, I think partly she wanted to write novels that are completely true to life. That was one of her main goals, even though, of course, she's creating characters and creating stories that didn't happen exactly in that way. She wants it to seem exactly like what could happen mm-hmm. in real life. And that was just the sort of story she wrote. And she was, I mean, while she read some novels that were set in different times that often were not so realistic, she continually favor those that were highly realistic. I mean, again, I think this might have been that niece or someone else who's talking about writing a novel who said, well, maybe I was thinking of setting it in Ireland. She says, well, since you don't know Ireland, you haven't lived there, you don't know what the manners and ways of life are, you shouldn't set it there because you won't get it right. And so she really wanted to get it right. And you can see this in almost every aspect of hers, that she really tries to, you know, show exactly how people would have behaved, how they would speak, and things like that.
David, do you know whether the niece ever went on to write that novel? I figure
actually,
after that.
No, she didn't.
I mean, I can see why.
That's right. Well, of course, it also could have been, I mean, you can see a lot of different points that Jane Austen is saying, well, you know, you don't do this and you don't do that. And she's being very polite, but one can perhaps read between the lines and get a sense that Jane Austen thinks there's a lot of problems in what the niece is writing. No, who knows? She didn't do it. Maybe that's right. She had the example of Jane Austen and not able to write something as good as that. She decided, well, there's no point.
Well, while we're talking about nieces, my niece is in town, and we were talking about the book. She's read it. And I was telling her that my favorite character is Mr. Collins. I find him hilarious. I just think she did such a good job of drawing that character. My niece just couldn't believe it because he's such a buffoon. What do you think of him, David?
Oh, I think he's a wonderful character. I think in many ways he is perhaps the funniest character in Jane Austen. I mean, he is someone who's almost so ridiculous that you have to wonder occasionally if he is almost there. She's exaggerated a little bit for the sake of kind of comic or literary effect. But whether or not that's true, he's a wonderful character. And I mean, some of the scenes, for example, the scene where he proposes to Elizabeth is one of the funniest scenes, I think, in all literature. It's just so
great.
Hilarious. And it's almost a parody of proposal scenes.
So you think he may be one of the funniest characters she's ever drawn in all
yes.
of her novels?
Huh? Yes. I have a particular love of him for his humor. I mean, there are just so many wonderful lines in which he what she does with him is something she often does with other people. She has them reveal their foolishness through what they say, often being unaware of it. He says things that he thinks are very sensible, but an intelligent person reading it can realize what an idiot he's making of himself.
And he does. David Shepherd is with us this morning as we reconvene the Mid-Morning Book Club, Pride and Prejudice, as I've been talking about for the last few weeks. I read the annotated version. Maybe you downloaded a version from your local library. I heard from a librarian when we chose this title who said you can go to the local libraries around here and get a downloaded version. Maybe this is a novel that you read a long time ago, you loved, maybe you've seen some of the recent movies. I'd be curious about your perspective, how you'd weigh in on our conversation this morning about Jane Austen. Why do you think readers are still so fascinated with Jane Austen's work? Why do you think new movies are being made? Two new movies coming out about Jane Austen in the next couple of weeks. Curious about your thoughts on that. 1-800-242-2828 in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online with us, minnesotapublicradio.org, click on send a question. How long ago did you first read Pride and Prejudice? What was your impression when you picked up Jane Austen's novel? 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Online with us, minnesotapublicradio.org, click on send a question. And David, guess what? My niece is on the line here with a question about Jane Austen. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Aunt Carrie.
What's your question?
What are the main values or virtues that Jane Austen is trying to teach?
What do you think, David? Values and virtues that Jane Austen is trying to teach us?
Well, I do think she is trying to teach us. I mean, she's not obtrusive in trying to teach us. She's not openly preaching, but she is, in the way she constructs a story, trying to encourage certain values. I think partly the value of acting rationally and sensibly, you know, not just sort of going overboard with your immediate impulse, the value of being objective about yourself, of examining your own possible faults. Mm-hmm. And that's something that the heroine at a critical moment, she admits that she made some critical errors of judgment and she did not know herself, that she thought she was acting out of some objective judgment when she was criticizing Darcy, but in fact she was acting out of prejudice and pride, and she comes to realize that about herself, and in doing so becomes better. So I think that's part of it. Also the value of being concerned with other people, and she has a vision of, she constantly focuses on love, but it's never love in which the two lovers isolate themselves from the world. It's always one in which they are part of a general social network and they are concerned about other people. So I think those are some of the values that she teaches, and I think especially this sort of self-awareness and a tendency to be aware of one's own faults or one's own flaws and weaknesses, and not always think that you yourself are in the right, but, you know, acknowledge that you may have made some serious mistakes.
David, what I really love about that self-awareness part of this is that we, the reader, are kind of ahead of Elizabeth, right? We see that the moment of recognition is coming for her. And yet it's funny, as she goes through the process, you know, she's hanging on to this prejudice that she has against Mr. Darcy. And yet bit by bit, it's falling away and she's still trying to hang on to it. And we, the reader, we're already ahead of that. And we know that the day is coming when she's going to have to reckon with the fact that her impression of him was totally wrong.
I think that's true. And of course, we're partly given the advantage of having the author at several points point out things about Darcy, about his real feelings toward her, mm-hmm. That, of course, she couldn't know herself. In addition, you know, we are given clues in terms of, often subtle clues, but some of the things that happen, like when she listens to the story told by Mr. Wickham, who hates Mr. Darcy. If you read it carefully, you can see that, in fact, there are a lot of flaws in his story, but she doesn't. She is sort of blinded and takes everything in that he says and thinks, oh, he's completely right, and therefore his complaints about Darcy must be completely justified. So yes, we are a little bit ahead of her, and we are sort of given an ability to see that she's making a mistake. Of course, also, we're kind of looking at it more objectively. We aren't personally involved as she is. At the same time, I think when you read it, you can also, though, still imagine yourself making those same mistakes. I mean, the kind of mistakes she makes are the sort of mistakes we all can. So I don't think it's necessary that we feel so totally superior to her, because we can, I think, you know, one can read it and think, oh, you know, I could easily see myself doing the same thing. Some of the things she's doing where she's sort of, you know, as you say, like being reluctant to give up a prior held opinion and admit that she was wrong. Well, I think we all do that. We all, if we're self-aware ourselves, we can admit that this is a problem that we can fall into.
It is kind of a condition of human nature, isn't it?
That's right.
1-800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000, as we talk about Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. I'm curious about when you first read the novel, why you think there are still so many fans of Jane Austen, to the point where there are new movies coming out, to the point where our guest's book, the annotated version of Pride and Prejudice, is selling well. There's still a lot of curiosity about the life of Jane Austen and a lot of readership out there of her novels all these years later. Why do you think that is? To Patty in Woodbury. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I wanted to say that I think that for me, her genius is that she makes you feel like you are, or she makes me feel like I am watching the story unfold with her.
Yeah.
And it's like watching it with a funny, smart friend.
That's absolutely true, Patty. That's a great observation. David, I love the way she does that too. She does it with the relationship with the sister and with, you know, her close friend Charlotte, and with her relationship with her father. It is a real gift that Jane Austen has for doing that.
That's right. I mean, she does, and she presents it through the, most of the story through the eyes of the main character, Elizabeth, but she also presents her in the context of these other characters. And these other characters are also interesting for pointing out contrasts. Each of these characters, either during the course of the novel, the ones you mentioned, all either during the course of the novel or earlier, made a marriage choices themselves, some cases not always the wisest choice. And that in turn then kind of provides a contrast with Elizabeth. And yes, we do see it through her eyes. We see what's happening, but then we also have, as you said, this sort of wise friend, the author, commenting on what's happening, providing a little more objective perspective than the heroine herself has.
Let me take a call from Jenna in St. Paul. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Carrie. You asked about when we first started reading Jane Austen.
Right.
I started as a little girl, 13 or 14, and of course I read it straight. I didn't get it. And then about, 15 years ago, I said, I got to do this, start it over again. And all of a sudden, you know, it all came clear, and I began to see the humor and the sort of, I'm reading Sense and Sensibility now for the second time. And again, I don't remember exactly, but I know that I did not read some of those scenes
and really understand them
the way I'm doing it now. So I think that's, I bet a lot of people have had my experience. That's one of the reasons why I think maybe, for me, it's why it's really exciting again to reread, because I know I didn't read it very well at the first time.
Jenna, thanks for the call. David Shepard, do you think you're ever too, you're really ever too young for Jane Austen, or is this the kind of novel you can come back to over and over and kind of peel back the layers and understand it in a different way?
Well, I don't know whether you are too, in principle, be too young. Obviously, if you're really young, it is very much, it's fairly sophisticated literature in the sense that it's a lot of things are very subtle points that are not easy to understand. Though I think even if you're young, you still can get, you may be able to get a lot of the basic story. But I do think it's something that certainly you can read over and over again. I mean, by now I've read almost all her novels multiple times, and each time I look at it, I still find new things about it, because she's such a subtle and clever writer. And she, again, that's one of her characteristics, that she doesn't beat you over the head with her points.
Mm-hmm.
She, develops them very quietly and sort of lets you sort of do a little of the work yourself, which in many ways is nice, because, you don't, it gives you sort of the constant stimulation of being able to read it over again and discover more.
To Kelly in Woodbury. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I was wondering, in Pride and Prejudice, he talks about, or she says that Mr. Darcy's income is a virtue. There's a whole scene at the party, one of the parties, where they're talking about that. And what do you think James is trying to tell us about money as a value?
Now, that's a good question, because money comes up so often in different ways.
I'm trying to remember what line again was that you're referring to?
You're talking about a scene, Kelly, where they're talking about Mr. Darcy's income?
Yeah, at one point they didn't like Mr. Darcy, but when they found out what his income was, suddenly he was virtuous. I think her mom and her aunts were laughing about that.
Oh, that's right. In the first scene when he appears, when they have a local dance, and he comes with his friend, and as soon as they, very quickly the rumor circulates about how wealthy he is. And everyone thinks, they're very impressed with him. Also, the fact that he's very sort of tall and handsome and impressive looking. Though then, as it turns out that he's sort of proud and arrogant and sort of looks down at everyone, then their opinion of him goes down. But certainly, his being so wealthy is sort of an automatic credential. And that is true in this society. People show respect for it. And certainly, a lot of people are really thinking, wouldn't he be a great catch? Wouldn't he be someone to get? And of course, especially you think about the situation of women at the time not really working or having career opportunities. The one chance they had of really sort of moving up or advancing themselves was to try to make an advantageous marriage, to marry someone who was wealthier than they were. So you get a lot of women who are ambitious in this way, or their parents, their mothers pushing them in this way, as Mrs. Bennet is, though you also get characters like the heroine who, doesn't simply think, because Darcy's rich, I'll have him. And if you think of like the proposal scene, it was clear, and Darcy himself later admits this, he thought that because he was so wealthy that all he had to do was propose to Elizabeth, and she would be at his feet and saying, I would love to marry you. Because he figured, anyone would love to marry me because I'm so wealthy. And he was really shocked when she says, I'm not going to marry you because I don't think you're a good person. And that was one of the things that shook him up and forced him to become more self-aware and to reform his character.
And we see the dynamic of that unfold very early in the novel at that ballroom scene where he's acting haughty and arrogant, and she's giving him a hard time because he doesn't even really know how to engage in small talk. And right then, she's not awed by him, even though she knows that he's wealthy. She sees him as having some pretty serious character flaws and realizes, or she thinks at that time, that he's not somebody she'd ever want to be involved with.
That's right. She does notice that, and she is willing to speak out. And even though some people are saying, you should try to curry his favor because he's so rich, she's not willing to do that. And And of course, as explained toward the end, that was in many ways perhaps part of her attraction to him, because up until that point, he had been always surrounded by these women who were always flattering him because they were so eager to marry him. And we have the character of Miss Bingley, his best friend's sister, mm-hmm. who is sort of does everything she can to flatter him and curry his favor and fawns on him in the hope that he'll actually marry her. But of course, he ends up being kind of disgusted with her because, you know, she's so over the top. But you do see that. And, you know, you see, of course, and you also see kind of the danger that someone, another person in Darcy's position, might have allowed that sort of flattery to go to his head and always remained arrogant and never have realized the need to couple his wealth with other qualities.
Let me grab one last call here before we break for news to Dan in Brooklyn Center. Hi, Dan. Thanks for waiting.
Yes. I always thought that Bridget Jones was a modern interpretation of Elizabeth, or a modern, reflection of Elizabeth. She would have a lot of the same observational abilities, but with quite a different set of values
yeah.
and morals.
Yeah, that's interesting. Have you seen Bridget Jones' Diary, David?
Yes, I have. I saw that movie. And as far as I know, she actually, the author of the book upon which the movie is based, directly had the model of Pride and Prejudice. And he actually calls the hero Darcy.
That's
and
right.
She supposedly had, was especially inspired by the miniseries that came out in the mid-1990s, starring Colin Firth as Darcy, that really caught on, especially because Colin Firth really attracted a lot of people. And then in the movie version, Colin Firth plays that same character. So I think there's very strong connections there. And I think it was definitely a model for that. And again, you know, the basic story is such a strong central story of the two people who are at odds with each other, who misunderstand each other, and then finally become reconciled, that it's a story you can then sort of transfer into very different settings, including the current day.
By the way, we were having a discussion this morning. I was in the station kitchen with a colleague, and we were arguing about our favorite Mr. Darcy's. So I know people have preferences out there. David, do you have one? Do you think someone portrayed him best of all, Firth, or the new guy in the latest movie?
I don't know. I mean, of course, it's different interpretations. In the new movie, he portrays Darcy as more sort of shy than
right,
proud,
right.
which is a little different than the novel, but I think it works all right in the context of the movie. So it's hard to say. I thought he did a very good job, though I also think Colin Firth did. I also think, you know, going back to a very early, much earlier time, Laurence Olivier in a movie version from 1940 also is excellent, though it's, again, a little different sort of Darcy than is in the novel. So, you know, different versions do their own adaptation of Darcy, and partly because film is a different medium than the novel, they end up inevitably altering a little bit the actual character of what appears.
David Shepherd is with us this morning. He is the editor of The Annotated Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. It was our selection this time around for the Mid-Morning Book Club. I hope you had a chance to read it. I hope at some point you've had a chance to read Pride and Prejudice and you have a perspective on it. Join the conversation. We're going to break for news, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. 1-800-242-2828 in the metro area, 651-227-6000. Online, minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Send a Question. David and I are going to talk about this. Another one of my favorite scenes, the scene where Elizabeth and Jane are talking about the fact that Elizabeth's friend Charlotte has accepted the proposal, the marriage proposal of the horrible Mr. Collins, and what this reveals about Jane Austen through what Elizabeth says in that scene. Stay tuned for that. Back in just a moment to the newsroom. Perry Finnelli. Hi, Perry.
Gary, the Los Angeles Times reports disagreements are brewing among military leaders and the Bush administration over troop levels in Iraq. The paper says the Pentagon wants to cut the number by nearly half next year because of the strain the deployments are causing the Army. The government is reporting some positive numbers on the economy this morning. Sales of new homes were up 2.8% last month, and factory orders for big-ticket items made their biggest gain in 10 months, jumping nearly 6% in July. Both reports were better than analysts expected. Fillmore County officials say E. coli bacteria has been found in the city water in Rushford. The state health department had already warned Rushford residents that the flooding had rendered the city's water supply unsafe for drinking and should not be used for cooking, bathing, or other household purposes. Fillmore County officials say the Rushford water system is being flushed out, but it's still not safe. They say running water or flushing toilets in private homes could introduce contaminants into the home's plumbing. After getting an update on flood recovery efforts from local officials in Winona this morning, Governor Tim Pawlenty pledged a vigorous effort to get flood-damaged communities in southeastern Minnesota back on their feet. Pawlenty was accompanied by FEMA Director David Paulison, who said FEMA recovery centers would be set up in each of the three counties declared federal disaster areas yesterday. He said the centers should be up and running next week. Union officials announced today whether clerical, technical, and healthcare workers at the University of Minnesota will authorize a strike if contract negotiations remain deadlocked. Ask Me officials say union members' salaries have lost ground to inflation, and the school's latest offer would make the situation even worse. School officials say the offer is fair and competitive. Partly sunny skies for the state today. High temperatures, upper 60s to upper 70s. Right now in the Twin Cities, partly sunny. Temperature 69. It's 10:37. Minnesota Public Radio News.
Mark your calendar. Friday, August 31st is Minnesota Public Radio Day at the State Fair. Come enjoy great events and broadcasts in Carousel Park. See lots of musical performances and watch a live broadcast of Midday with Gary Eichten. There'll be goodies from the Lake Wobegon store. We'll have information on membership and lots more. Everything you want to know about the fair is at minnesotapublicradio.org. Just click on State Fair in the shortcuts menu. We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Mid-Morning is going to be at the fair on Tuesday. The first hour, NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner is going to be with us to talk weather. The second hour, we're rocking there at the stage at Minnesota Public Radio. We've got two DJs from the current Bill DeVille, Mark Wheat, joining me. We're going to talk about, one of the things we're going to talk about is the death of the album. This is something Bill and Mark have been talking about on their Music Heads podcast. So we'll continue the conversation. I hope you'll stop in. If you're headed to the fair early on Tuesday, and I know it's a little early out there, stop by and see us. Be great to see you in the audience. Back to our conversation this hour. David Shepherd is with us. He annotated Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. David, I'm going to go right back to the phones. We've got some people holding here who want to give us their view, and I'm curious to hear it. To Sherry in St. Paul. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I am a high school English teacher.
Mm.
I've taught this book for many years, and increasingly, I think because of the movie, I have problems telling students why this novel is important, why it has literary merit. I try to point out the cleverness of the prose, et cetera, but they just don't get it. They think it's fluff. So what would you say to them?
But Sherry, that's ironic. So the movie has made this seem like a much less serious novel, huh?
Indeed. I think it's made it so accessible that they see it as plot only or something.
Yeah. David, what about that?
Well, I don't know. Of course, I've not had the experience of having to teach high school students. I've tried to teach college students, and that can be hard enough. I would imagine it could be even harder with high school students. I don't know. I think you can point out that yes, you know, you can say, well, it's a nice love story and there's a lot of comedy there, but there's also first insight into human nature. She shows very subtle character portraits, and you get even ones that have a kind of very tragic dimension of, like, say, Elizabeth's father, who has made a very bad marital choice and is then kind of retreated into kind of sarcasm and cynicism because of this. You also see what we've already talked about, some of the sort of moral lessons that she's trying to draw about, you know, well, these people don't simply fall in love and everything's nice and there are no problems. They both have to undergo an educational process of realizing their faults and realizing the mistakes they've made. And so, you know, that could be something that might help make people understand some of the merit of the book and why it isn't simply a nice love story, that there's more to it than that.
You know, I think Sherry was talking, I was thinking about some of the Shakespeare plays that have, Kenneth Branagh has been, you know, reproducing, remaking some of the Shakespeare plays. And I have wondered, even though you can tell he loves Shakespeare and the movies are wonderful, I do wonder if it does take something away from the literature.
Well, I suppose it could, of course, if it's seen as a substitute for it. Again, you know, what a film is different than reading something, and you can do certain things, especially visually in a film, obviously can't do in a book, but inevitably the language is not going to be emphasized as much. And in the case of either Austen or Shakespeare, because the language is such a great part of the value, then, you know, inevitably that will be slighted in the film. So I think if the film becomes a substitute for the book or the play, then that's a problem. But if it's a way to lead people into it and read it on their own, then I think it still is very useful.
You know, I want to talk about the scene, David, before we go back to the phones here, that one of the other scenes that you, in your annotation, said was quite revealing about Jane Austen's own principles. And this is the scene where Elizabeth is upset when she hears that Charlotte has accepted Mr. Collins's marriage proposal. And she says to her sister Jane, "You shall not defend her, even though it's Charlotte Lucas. You shall not, for the sake of one individual, change the meaning of principle and integrity, not endeavor to persuade yourself or me that selfishness is prudence and insensibility of danger, security for happiness." You say in the annotation that she's expressing a fundamental principle of Jane Austen's. What is that?
Well, the principle that there are certain objective principles of right and wrong that are more, they're superior to any one individual. In other words, you do not make any individual your ultimate judge. So even though a certain person like Charlotte Lucas is your friend and has shown a lot of good qualities, you don't automatically say, well, whatever she does, therefore, must be right. If she does something that you think is wrong or foolish, you say it is that way. And therefore, you say, well, maybe there is something, there's a flaw in her that I haven't noticed before, that the principles have a validity that goes beyond the individual. And I think that is a fundamental principle. And you also see that in the case of Elizabeth or Darcy, even though they're both basically generally good people and people have many qualities, they also end up doing things wrong. And they are forced to acknowledge that. And Elizabeth is forced to acknowledge, even though she thinks of herself as being, you know, someone who is always doing the right thing, that she's made a serious error. And Darcy, similarly, very proud of himself, thinking of himself always as being on top of everything. Again, he is told, well, at one point, you did not behave like a true gentleman. And that really shocks him and forces him to change. And so that is a basic principle that she is trying to say there are these objective principles. And those who violate them, no matter how good they may be overall, have still done something wrong.
To Melanie in Eden Prairie. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. I really enjoyed the discussion, David. I'm going to have to run out and get your book. I wrote so many papers on this novel during high school that my teachers were sick of them, and my sister actually wrote her master's thesis on Jane Austen.
Wow.
Had a master's in English literature, and I hope she's listening. One of the discussions that she and I have raged back and forth with each other about through the years is that we were wondering if you, in your more professional and learned opinion, would consider this to be a proto-feminist novel, simply because Elizabeth displays so many characters that I think that I, as a modern feminist, you know, can really appreciate in her, such as her interest in self-education, her unwillingness to enter into a marriage which would have been very socially advantageous and which her family greatly desired. And yet I'm desperately trying to search in my brain for the name of a contemporaneous author who said they met her and thought that she was the silliest, most giggling, marriage-obsessed, sort of little nothing that they'd ever met. And I'll go ahead and take your comments off here.
Melanie, thanks so much for the call.
I believe the person that who said that, it was a woman named Mary Mitford. I think either she or someone she knew said that. She was somebody who wrote some things. That has been often discussed. Some people say, well, she didn't really know Jane Austen well and may have just been sort of personal jealousy. Though, of course, she's also referring to Jane Austen when Jane Austen would have been about 20 years old or so. So, you know, maybe she was at that point not as sort of serious and thoughtful a person as she was later. Of course, obviously, not all of us necessarily we want to judge for our entire life on how we behave, let's say, when we were 18 or 20. In addition, in terms of the whole issue of, you know, whether you can say she was a proto-feminist, well, I should add that that's something that people often have discussed, and you can certainly find arguments in either way. I think that, I mean, she doesn't openly preach a political message. She does certainly show a female characters who have a strength of character and integrity and intelligence and who are willing to stand up and, for example, not marry someone that they do not respect or do not think is a good person. And she certainly shows a strong support for the idea of women becoming well-educated. At the same time, she doesn't openly criticize the existing structure of society in which, you know, women were not working or anything like that. So it's hard to say. I think that, you know, there were debates in the time about women's position and women's education. We don't know exactly where she stood, but certainly I think she would have sympathized with those who were saying that even if there were still somewhat separate roles for men and women, that women should still receive good education, should be encouraged to develop their minds. And, you know, she criticizes those women who simply, you know, are only interested in attracting a husband and not in cultivating qualities, and as well as those men who do not appreciate intelligence and character in a woman.
David, I'm going to close our conversation here because we have a Friday follow segment with a comment here that we got online and then a question for you. So from Elizabeth in Minneapolis, she says, "It seems so funny to hear a guy talking on the radio about Jane Austen. I don't know many men who have willingly read her novels. Do you think that's true?"
Well, I think there are a lot of men who have liked her. I certainly think it is true that there are far more women who have liked her. I will admit in my own case, you talk about when you first read Jane Austen. I mean, I think that's partly because women tend to read more fiction, men perhaps more nonfiction. I mean, I've heard that in terms of like publishing statistics and things like that. Mm-hmm. But And I think Jane Austen, because she does concentrate on female characters, perhaps a lot of men, I think, tend to think of her, oh, that's just chick lit, I don't want to read her. I think that's not true. I think you can appreciate the story, and I did. In my own case, it is true that I only came to discover her later in life. I didn't read her that much, and partly because I didn't read fiction so much when I was younger. And, you know, when I first read Pride and Prejudice, when I was in college, I liked it, but wasn't so taken with it. And it wasn't until later that I learned to appreciate it, in part because reading some authors who commented on her and talked about some of the deeper meanings in her, that I began to say, oh, maybe there's something more there. And then when I went back and read her, I really fell in love with her writing and began to see a lot of her qualities.
Well, you can tell that this became something, well, as I said, it was a labor of love to annotate.
It certainly was.
No question. Okay, here's my last question for you. I always ask the guests who join us for our mid-morning book clubs for a recommendation for a future mid-morning book club. Another novel. What do you think we ought to read? What can I put on the list?
That's a tough one. I don't know what kind of books you normally have.
All over the map. I'll tell you what. You email me. You think about it and you email me. And we'll put it on the list, all right? How's that?
All right. Okay.
I'll let you off the hook. But I do want to hear from you, all right?
Okay. I mean, if you're thinking about other classic novels, I, for example, am another novelist that I discovered and I think is very accessible is Anthony Trollope.
Oh, excellent.
Barchester Towers is one that's most accessible, though there are some of his, especially later ones, more serious that in many ways I think are even more interesting.
But I think that's a great suggestion. It goes on the list. David, thanks so much. This has really been fun.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
David Shepherd is annotator and editor of The Annotated Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. We're talking about writing in our Friday Follow segment today as well, but this isn't fiction, it's memoir writing. When we first met Beryl Bissell last summer, she just published the story of what had been an extraordinary life. She was a teenager when she decided she wanted to enter a convent, and her first book, The Scent of God, reveals what it was like to leave her parents and her friends and join a community of nuns. In this excerpt, she described the moment of leaving her parents on the outside and entering a very different world.
When I walked down the hall, my father said, Beryl, you can change your mind. You don't have to go through with this. But I wanted this so badly, and I went forward to the doors with joy. My mother was standing stiff like she was frozen. And I embraced her quickly and then turned, and as I was walking through the door, she cried out, I'll never be able to hug you again. And it didn't bother me at the time, but I remember turning around at that last moment and seeing. All I could see was my brother's madras jacket outside the door. And I went in between those doors with such happiness. And it was only periodically that I would be overwhelmed with this sense of loss for my parents.
The book also chronicles the unexpected choices that Beryl Bissell made that led her out of the convent into a marriage with a former priest and the tragedy that she's coped with since then. And that's where Beryl Bissell, who now lives in northern Minnesota, is picking up the story for her next memoir. Beryl, it's a real pleasure to have you back on the program.
Oh, thank you, Carrie. I'm so pleased to be here.
I remember you saying that if you thought that first book was difficult to write, you knew the second memoir was going to be very difficult. Have you found that to be such?
Absolutely. I spent a lot of time this past year gathering notes from my journals and medical records of my daughter. I should point out that my daughter was killed in 2001. And I thought this book originally was going to be a losing Francesca dealing with the unresolved guilt for some of the choices that I made in my life that led, I believe, were contributed to her death and grief. And instead, as I'm writing now, I'm finding that it's becoming a looking for Francesca. 6 months after she died, I made a trip to the house where she died. I'd never been there before, and I had to find my way there, and it was a traumatic experience. But when I got there, I thought, what am I doing here? Did I come to try to resolve the mystery of her death, which has never been resolved, or am I still looking for her? I spent so many years during her teenage age is that I could never find her. She was always running away, and I thought, I'm still looking for her. And so this is what this book is going about, to try to find the real Francesca, because I realized I really did not know her that well.
Have you discovered, as you go through your journals, that you remember things the way you wrote them in your journals, or are you discovering that time and history have changed things a bit in your mind?
Well, with regard to my daughter, the journal sections, they're right on target.
Are they?
Yes, but prior to that, I lived in dreams. I kept creating this dream world that the marriage I was in was a happy marriage, and it was a nightmare. And as I remember it, it was a nightmare. But when I go back and read my journals, I read always these happenings that made me believe that this marriage could endure. So that's the one thing that I found very contrasting. And I throw up my hands when I'm reading those sections, and I think, how could I have written that?
Your grandson is going to read. Your daughter, Francesca, had a son, and he is going to read this memoir that you write someday, I imagine. Are you conscious of that as you write?
Very, very conscious. And it's a concern to me because as of now, he still doesn't know how his mother died. And I thought, I'm hoping that nobody in the family is listening to this interview, but I am prepared. And I think it's important that he know who his mother was because she was an extremely sensitive and beautiful individual, one that I think was never really meant to live on this earth. She just couldn't cope with the difficulties of life. And she was very courageous because she did try very, very hard, but never quite came to terms with the person who she was. And that's the person that I'm seeing in her poetry and in the letters that she wrote to me, and mostly a lot of it in the medical records, which reveal this child who wanted to be normal like other people were so desperately, and whose greatest suffering was the separation that had occurred between the two of us because of her drug abuse.
Beryl, I know that you go out into a writing shed on your property every day to write. You spend a couple hours there every day?
Yes, usually I try to put in at least 2 hours there, but I'm doomed if I sit in front of the computer with access to email because inevitably I get caught up in that. So I try to go out there first thing. There's no internet communication out there. So.
I was trying to imagine what your writing shed looks like on the inside, and I wondered if you'd hung photographs of your daughter and some of the poetry to inspire you as you write this.
Absolutely. There are photos of Francesca and also a huge happy sun that she drew when she was in the third grade, and it makes me smile every time I look at it. But yes, and I have, you know, I put flowers in front of her photo, and I light a candle when I write because I sense her closeness to me. I sense her wanting me to tell this story.
I'm looking forward to the memoir, the second memoir. I hope you'll come in and talk about it with us. When do you think it'll be published?
I have no idea. It took me 8 years to write the first one. But I am working on this, and I've already completed, I would say, the first third of the book. So I'm on my way. Let's put it that way.
Go ahead.
There's no deadline.
It's wonderful to check in with you, Beryl. Thanks so much. And do keep in touch with us, all right?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Carrie.
Beryl Bissell joining us this morning, writing the second memoir. Her first memoir was called The Scent of God. It was a story of how she decided as a very young girl that she wanted to enter a convent. She did that. Her life's path led her back out of the convent. She ended up marrying a former priest. And she now lives in northern Minnesota and is writing the story of her life. She's on the second part of her memoir. Mid-Morning, produced by Nancy Lieben, Susan Leem, Chris Dahl, technical directors Randy Johnson and Steve Griffith. Coming up on Mid-Morning on Monday at 10. I'm looking forward to this. The book was just hilarious. Bill Buford is a writer for The New Yorker. And he decided a few years ago that he was going to get a job in the kitchen of one of the finest Italian restaurants in New York City, run by this, well, you've heard of him, Mario Batali, this volatile chef, I guess is the only way I can describe it, and the experiences that Bill Buford had in the kitchen of Baba were just amazing. So he's going to join us on Monday morning at 10 to talk about the book that came out of those experiences called Heat. Tuesday, Mid-Morning, is at the fair, and I hope if you are too, you'll stop by and see us. First hour, we're talking with NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner, talking all about the weather. That should keep us nice and busy, given the kind of season that we've had this summer. And then the second hour, Mark Wheat and Bill DeVille, you probably hear them on 89.3 The Current. Every now and then, they cross over and join us over here at KNOW, and we're going to talk music. One of the things we're going to talk about is the death of the album. That's Tuesday at the fair. This is Mid-Morning.